put him in the Heisman.
Got that award right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light Seltzer for those anytime easy drinking occasions.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team that's going to bring back a College World Series title. The Bomb Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast.
Want to get into the best rivalries in sports right now here on the Morning Rush. Watch the Best of Enemies or the Best of Enemies documentary on ESPN yesterday, and it was great. And I hadn't seen it in quite some time. I'd watched, I think, episode one a while back, but I hadn't watched it all the way through all three. The Best of Enemies doc is on the Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics, starting from the Bill Russell days. It even actually went back to the George Mikan Minneapolis Lakers days, and then went into the Boston Celtics, and it was fantastic. Have you watched that before?
I have not. And that's probably one of my favorite eras in all of sports. Is what, you know, and that's one thing I've really liked and enjoyed about this Last Dance series, is going back and seeing some of that great stuff from the 80s. Now, obviously, I don't go back as far as George Mikan, but that was some of the best days of the NBA.
Yeah, and it was really, say, the NBA, for those who don't remember, the finals were recorded and played back later in the day. It took CBS Sports getting after Brent Musburger and that whole crew, really galvanizing the NBA. And it was really mad. It was two guys. It was Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and they're really the centerpiece of this doc, as it should be. This is the best rivalry in the history of sports, the 80s Los Angeles Lakers and the 80s Boston Celtics. There will not be anything close to that rivalry. They met in the finals most years in the 80s. One of them, either the Lakers or the Celtics, were in the finals every single year in the 80s decade. That's incredible. Yeah, the Lakers won in 80, Celtics won in 81, Lakers won in 82, Lakers lost to Philly in 83, Celtics beat the Lakers in 84, Lakers got revenge in 85, Celtics beat the Rockets in 86, Lakers beat the Celtics in 87, Lakers beat the Pistons in 88, and then Lakers lost to the Pistons in 89. So it's pretty incredible, the fact that those two franchises locked up the 80s pretty much.
Had a great run in the 80s till some guy named Jordan came along in the early 90s and took over. Yeah. And it was well-timed because you had two stars in Bird and Magic, and then it just was perfect. Even though, you know, Jordan was in the league, those were the stars of the league to the late 80s. And then Jordan really took over and transitioned late 80s.
The transition was pretty cool. And it got me thinking as I'm watching this doc yesterday, all right, what are some other rivalries I really enjoy? Now, these can be within Arkansas sports. This can be outside of the SEC. It's just rivalries in general. And a couple of those came to my mind yesterday.
Let's think about just mano a mano rivalries, because you're talking about Magic Bird. That was really the deal there. I mean, think about things like Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer. I mean, you think about some of these, you know, Tiger and Phil. I mean, I know it can be team sports, but there's still the individual rivalry that really started. I don't say started; started way before Magic and Bird, but that's really the guys you think about in that series.
Well, it elevates what happens, and the same could be said about Bill Russell and Jerry West. What happens is you have a team rivalry, and it's elevated by the individual rivalry. When you have two teams, especially the polar opposites of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. Now, everyone always wants to say, oh, well, it's white versus black. No, no, no. It's not just that. It's the charismatic versus the won't say anything. It's the different parts of where they grew up, one in East Lansing, one in French Lick. They were so different in so many ways, and that's what made that rivalry so special. And you can talk about Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer in this, maybe not in the exact same sense, but Arnold was more social, correct? Mm-hmm. Jack was more I don't know if introverted is the right word, because it wasn't necessarily that.
But stoic?
He didn't have the same charisma as Arnold Palmer, because that's where he's regarded in his field as one of the best to ever do in that regard.
Think about Bo Schembechler and Woody Hayes, you know, and that great rivalry between two head coaches. I mean, I, you know, there's been a lot of great rivalries. I'm trying to think of what would be the best one with Muhammad Ali. I'm not as well versed. Joe Frazier or George Foreman would be the two names I would throw out, but probably Joe Frazier. So, you know, just thinking about individual kind of guys that get out. And it's really hard for that to happen in college sports unless it's coaches, because far too often they're not around long enough to develop these rivalries. But you think about Magic and Bird, where did it start? It started in college, right? Started in the Final Four back in the late 70s. So that's where that rivalry really began.
In the national championship, yep, in 79 when the Indiana State Sycamores lost to Magic Johnson's Michigan State Spartans when they shouldn't have been there because they were helped by the refs in the Elite Eight game to get to that Final Four. But when you think about the South, when you think about football, there's one rivalry that has to be mentioned in this sentence, and it's Auburn-Alabama. And when you have a documentary, an ESPN 30 for 30, an SEC story on this Roll Tide War Eagle, which was fantastic. If you haven't gotten a chance to watch it, you need to. Here is a little clip from that and why this rivalry is so special.
It's difficult to describe, particularly to someone who doesn't live here. It's really the Israelis and the Palestinians living together in one place, day in, day out. Two sides that have a long history of hate, but it also helps make it the most intense, dramatic, passionate, compelling rivalry in all of sports.
Al is in Dadeville, Alabama. Hey, Al.
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Well, thanks.
This year, I was at the Iron Bowl, and I saw where they put a Scam Newton jersey on Bear Bryant's statue. Well, let me tell you what I did. I went to Auburn, Alabama, sure, and I poisoned the two tumors trees.
Is that against the law to poison a tree?
Well, do you think I care? Roll damn tide.
We know after the fact that was, in fact, if I could say that again, Harvey Updike.
Right.
That was not, who did he say, Allen, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. So the real reason I play that clip is to scarf down some spaghetti in the 45 seconds.
What
I
a
had.
Professional. Mouth is full there for a little bit.
What a professional.
Yeah.
That's how heated this rivalry is you're willing to destruct property and kill trees. Now, in Harvey Updike's mind, they had destructed property by putting that Cam Newton jersey on Bear Bryant's statue. That was a bridge too far for him. And that's how heated that thing gets.
How big of an idiot do you have to be, though, to literally call into a national radio show? Yes, he used a different name, but
most criminals, most people that will go that far, want to be caught because they want the attention. Harvey Updike would have never been satisfied just to kill the trees, and people think it was some kind of natural
disaster.
You know, just died of old age. You know, that would not have sat. He needed people to know. He needed the world to know that he was responsible for it, and all the criminal matters he had to go through as a result of that were worth it to him, because in the Auburn circles, maybe more privately than publicly, he's a hero. I mean, not in the Alabama circles.
Easy.
I said that back. In the Alabama circles, he's a hero.
And that won't go, as you mentioned, that no one will say that
they won't
publicly.
Say it, right. You know, and
Greg Byrne and the Alabama LD won't come out and say, we are with Harvey Updike.
I'm telling you, there's a large faction of that Alabama fan base that hold him as a hero. And he will be an Alabama legend, maybe a dubious legend, but he will always be a name that's associated with that rivalry. There's no way you tell the story of that rivalry without Harvey Updike. So that's just part of, you know, this rivalry conversation, and I think the greatest college football rivalry ever. You got to throw Michigan, Ohio State in there somewhere.
It's on my list as well.
Texas, Oklahoma. I don't know who else you throw in there, but to me, and particularly the last 12 years, 10 years, you know, you look at what they did with playing in three national title games in that state, winning three national titles in that state in 3 years. It's pretty incredible.
You remember those bunch of hooligans that went down to Starkville a year or so ago and spray painted their bulldog red and had Razorback red on it? You remember that?
Yeah.
I don't think that Arkansas fans, like, privately were like, those guys are heroes or whatever. I have a feeling that if it happened in Lexington with something, with like an Adolph Rupp statue, or if you went down to Austin, I feel like Arkansas fans, as much as they hate Texas, there's a lot of respect for Darryl Royal. I don't know if you'd want anyone messing that, but I'm kind of in that line of thinking where if an Arkansas fan did something to a heated and hated rival publicly, we would condemn them. But privately, it might be one of those things behind closed doors where like, yeah, that's one of us.
I can't remember all the details of the story. I think it was Rice and SMU. Maybe you can Google this, Jenkins, that the band was marching on their field, on their opponent's field at pregame or halftime. They all had planned and put fertilizer in their pockets. So when they formed their logo or the school name, I think it was Rice at SMU, they all dropped a big handful of fertilizer on the ground. Well, it killed the grass. But it killed it with the name of their rival on the field. Those are the kind of things that only get born out of, well-intended hatred, I guess.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
I've got some of those details wrong, but I remember that legendary story.
I know if you talk about like hated rivalries, and it's not as tenured as like an Auburn-Alabama, but you look at like Notre Dame and Miami from the 80s and 90s.
Catholics versus convicts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about the Lou Holtz, Jimmy Johnson dynamic? And what makes these rivalries very interesting and what makes them so appealing is when you have two coaches or two players that are so different in so many ways. Like, as I mentioned with Magic and Bird, Alabama and Auburn, they're pretty similar. Ohio State, Michigan, pretty similar. But it's those one or two players, it's those two coaches that add a dynamic to that rivalry that make it so important. Because you can't just have teams that, if you want the rivalry to take a next step, you have to have an individual rivalry within and inside the team rivalry to elevate that even higher and to increase that hatred tenfold.
So Magic and Bird, that's kind of where this conversation began with the Celtics and Lakers in the 80s. And we've been watching The Last Dance. Who was really Michael Jordan's chief rival? Was it Isaiah Thomas? I mean, I know that there was no love lost between those two, but once they kind of got past the Pistons in the early 90s, that was the last you heard of the Bad Boy Pistons. So if you had to say Michael Jordan
that team.
So who would have been, did anyone even rise close to the level to be a rival considered in the same sentence with Michael Jordan?
We had this conversation last week. You think about the teams and particularly the individuals that he kept from winning championships. Patrick Ewing's won. Gary Payton won one with the Miami Heat later in his career. That's one that he could have prevented from having a few more. You can talk about Reggie Miller. You can talk about the Bad Boy Pistons team that he ended, because you got to remember, the Bad Boy Pistons went to the finals in 89 and 90. And they won, and 88. So they won it. They should have won three, but got screwed by a bad call at the end of game six where Bill Laimbeer didn't touch Kareem and they called a foul on him. So they went in 88, 89, and 90, 1-2. And Jordan and company just ended them in 91. They never recovered after that. It's not like they were just extremely old or anything. So that's one. That definitely stands out as one. You think about, I know Clyde Drexler won with the Houston Rockets later in his career, but I mean, he hurt his career very bad and what he was able to do. 93, Charles Barkley, I would say Chuck or Patrick Ewing are the two that stand out to me as ones that were just, they couldn't get out from under Jordan, because you think about the Knicks and you think about that, and so Jordan was just able to effectively end so many players, not destinies, but them trying to get to a finals because of how good he was.
Yeah. Hey, are you looking for a new place to call home? If you're tired of your noisy neighbors and looking to upgrade your apartment, if you're looking for a new duplex or townhome to live in, call our friends at Trinity Multifamily. Whether it's Northwest Arkansas, the River Valley, Hot Springs, or Central Arkansas, Trinity Multifamily manages thousands of units across the natural state. They manage property in over 15 different states. Search online for available units at trinitymultifamily.com or call 479-452-1817. That's 452-1817. Trinity Multifamily is your teammate in the real estate game.
If you're just jumping in on the conversation, we're talking best rivalries in sports. Watch the Best of Enemies documentary on ESPN with the Celtics and the Lakers, talking about that this morning. We've mentioned Alabama, Auburn, Ohio State, Michigan, Texas, Oklahoma, and we'll get into some others as well. Got a call in right now. Michael's in Little Rock wanting to talk about this subject. Michael, you go ahead.
Hey, what's up, guys? So, yeah, obviously, you didn't mention the last one, that the last dynasty, could have been dynasty that Jordan defeated Utah Jazz, Karl Malone, and John Stockton. Obviously, that's a given. Also, obviously, Arkansas LSU, back when Nick Saban was coaching LSU, you know, we had the Milcar Markham. Everyone who remembers that was seeing replays of that. And then Cardinals and Cubs. A lot of us guys from Arkansas like the Cardinals, and so many other people like the Cubs as well. That's kind of like a friendly rivalry as well. So those would be mine. Anyway, I'm going to be majoring in journalism, so I'll probably be in favor of meeting a lot of guys in journalism. You guys are so good. Hit that line, Arkansas ESPN. You, Tyrician, Tommy Kraft. You guys are amazing. And I hope to talk to you guys pretty soon.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it, buddy.
Thank you for those kind words. We appreciate it.
Yeah, that's LSU-Arkansas rivalry is always fun. That's close to home. It's your team going against it. We've talked about the Texas-Arkansas rivalry multiple times, and Michael brought up a good point. You think about the tough times that Karl Malone and John Stockton had to go through in 97 and 98, whether it was Steve Kerr hitting game-winning shots, whether it was Michael Jordan going through a supposed flu game, whether it was Malone getting the ball ripped from him at the end of Game 6 in 1998, and Jordan hitting the shot over Byron Russell to seal the deal and win that finals. Yeah, the Utah Jazz, what they had to go through, Jerry Sloan and company, those are some tough losses as well.
Yeah, and who was responsible for all of that for most of those guys?
Particularly Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, he as fun as he is to watch, he's a thorn in a lot of people's sides when it comes to basketball.
And to me, that's what ends all the LeBron versus Jordan or Kobe versus Jordan or anybody versus Jordan talk. Whoever, for a brief period of time, had the best to Michael Jordan? No one. I mean, Michael always turned out the victor in the end.
Well, you could say the Pistons in both 89 and 90. You could say the Magic in 95 when he came back, but it's very...
But he ended the Pistons dynasty and then went on to win six.
But you said who had him for a little bit.
I'm just telling you, Michael Jordan. In the end, who was the king of the mountain in every one of those conversations? Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Because you came back, let's see. So after the 95, this would have been, I think, the Eastern Conference semifinals when they faced off against the Magic. Jordan's coming off that shortened season. He's wearing the number 45. Game one, they're up one, and he gets the ball stolen from Nick Anderson from the back, and the Magic end up going down and scoring, going up one, and then Jordan turns the ball over, and he just wasn't himself in that series against the Magic in 95. Comes back the next year, and they just throttle the Orlando Magic. Just absolutely, you can tell, because one of the things that makes Michael Jordan so great that you've got to see through in this Last Dance documentary is his persistence and his motivation factor. He always found something to motivate him, whether it was a loss the previous year, whether it was a sports writer saying, oh, this guy's better than Michael, or is the equivalent to Michael. Michael's like, no, that's not true. That's not how this flies around here. He was so good at individually motivating himself, and that's what made him great.
Yeah, and he would, even the deal with George Karl, and I just saw the kind of some of the pieces of it and heard the guys. I hadn't watched all of 7 and 8 last night, but George Karl apparently snubbed, or Michael Jordan thought he snubbed him in a restaurant in, I guess, is the 95 finals, and Jordan turned that into motivation. Jordan even admitted that sometimes he just makes some things up in his own head to create motivation, but he was really good at taking those small things that he felt were disrespectful to him or his team and turning those into just a burning, raging fire within him.
Yeah.
And that's what made him better than anybody else.
Another fun rivalry to watch is the Yankees and Red Sox. And the Yankees had the Red Sox for quite some time. We know about the curse of the great Bambino and what followed the Red Sox history after that. They finally got it done. In my opinion, the best 30 for 30 is 4 days in October. And this is from a non-baseball fan. But that documentary with Kevin Millar being really the spokesman for the Red Sox that year. It was Curt Schilling. I mean, that team was Manny Ramirez and Ortiz. That team was loaded, and they looked like they were going to get swept by the New York Yankees after following the previous year in seven games in the, I believe, the ALCS. They end up coming back three games to, down 3-0, which has never happened in the history of the MLB. And I think it might happen once in hockey, but I think in the history of sports, anyone that's been down 3-0 to that point has never been able to come back. And what they were able to do was awesome. It was unbelievable, and it finally got them over the hump and got them over the curse.
It broke the curse, yeah. And then from then on, they kind of rolled and had the swagger and the confidence as a franchise to – to do even more. So
did they beat the Cardinals that year in 04, or was that another team they beat?
They did beat the Cardinals in the World Series, but I don't remember if it was 04. Was it 04? It was 04. I was at one of those games the last time the Cardinals and the Red Sox played, and we were sitting. They've also played
it's Cardinals.
They played one other time too since then. I'm trying to remember what year that was.
Was it
Anyway, I remember we were seated in a section at the World Series, and above us and to our left was a suite that had been rented by a bunch of Boston Red Sox fans. So they were, when the stadium was quiet there in St. Louis because things were not going the Cardinal way, as you like to say, these guys were chirping. It was creating a little friction up in their section. So
Michael also brought up the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry. Now, for quite some time, the Cardinals dominated this rivalry, but since the Cubs have been a little better as of late, it's been a little more even, and it helps when the Cubs talk about curses. I mean, you think about the curse of the Billy Goat. Have you been to Chicago, what, once?
I've never been to Chicago.
So when you go to Chicago, you need to go to Billy Goat's Tavern because it's a legendary restaurant. The food's just okay, but you just want to go over there for the ambiance and just to say they were there. But you know about the curse. Do you know about the curse of the Billy Goat?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. So legend goes that they wouldn't let a guy and his goat into Wrigley back in the day. Yeah. And that just
infuriated him. He declared a curse before he left.
And it lasted.
He's being kicked out.
Yeah, and it lasted all the way up to 2017. Yeah, so that's when they finally got it done. But
I guess the most famous instance to point to is the Bartman ball.
Man, yeah, you know, that's something. And I think he was presented with either one of the game balls or something. But I mean, you think about the crap he got from Cubs fans.
It ruined his life.
Yeah, 100%. Like
he still lives there. I mean, that's what
he still lives in Chicago.
Well, he did. I saw a documentary on him and this. It was some behind the scenes. But at that time, he was still living there, going to work. You know, all this stuff.
Man, that's a scam.
But it ruined his life. I mean, death threats, people coming after him. Yeah, I mean, it was not good.
And it's hard to find a balance because you think about the intensity of rivalries, and that's Bartman's thing. It's not really a rivalry in the discussion, but you think about the death threats. You think about some of the stuff that has been presented or shown as like evidence as, hey, this rivalry's been taken a little too far. Sometimes fans, like as a Harvey Dupdyke, and we brought up earlier, it unfortunately gets too much.
Yeah. So that's the problem, is you take it a step too far and it becomes a mob mentality, or you get into this fan base. And now with Twitter and social media and message boards and all that, we get swept up into the emotion of it all.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a premium light lager brewed with real lemonade.
He does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number 3, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
Welcome back into the Morning Rush. Our next guest, NBA draft, NBA cover, and college basketball over the Athletic, Sam Vecenie now joins us. Sam, appreciate the time. I want to start with Mason Jones. I saw that you commented on his post a while back when he announced that he was signing with the CAA and foregoing his senior year to go to the NBA draft. You were expecting this. Why did you expect Mason Jones to stay in the NBA draft?
Yeah, first and foremost, it's just been kind of heading this way, talking to people around, college basketball, around the NBA. It's been heading this way since basically February, I would say, is around the time that I heard that he was more likely to go than to stay in college basketball next season. And on his part, I think it's pretty understandable. I mean, I'm just not sure what more he's going to be able to do next season. I mean, I don't quite think he should have necessarily won SEC Player of the Year, but he also averaged 22.5 rebounds and 3 assists a game. And, you know, from an offensive production standpoint, it's really hard to top what he did this year. So I'm just kind of looking at it. And in that case, when you hear from NBA teams that it's more likely that he's going to go than he's not going to go, and you look at it from his standpoint, and he's got to be thinking, man, what more do I have to do to get on NBA radars? I think it's kind of expected. Plus, he's going to be 22, if I remember correctly, here coming up in, I think it's like July or August. So, you know, he's a little bit older, and it's time to go pro, basically.
And you bring up a good point, and I've mentioned this several times, Sam. I know you don't follow recruiting as heavily, but Arkansas's got a top five recruiting class coming in, a couple pretty highly coveted grad transfers, so they're going to have some guys. They're going to take some looks away from him this season, so that's a great point from you. I remember...
Yeah, that's 100% right. I mean, like, Moses Moody's awesome. Moses Moody is going to get some shots next year. So, you know, K.K. Robinson's going to be good. If Isaiah Joe comes back, it's going to be... He's going to be really good. So it's definitely a situation where there are going to be fewer shots to go around. And again, if you're Mason Jones, you know, what else do you have to do?
Sam, I want to come back to something you said just a minute ago. I think I heard you say you didn't think Mason Jones should have won SEC Player of the Year. Is that what you said? If so, why do you feel that way?
Yeah, I think that it's a similar reason to why his draft stock is not as high as what I think that the production would dictate, is maybe the way to put it. I thought he was abysmal defensively this year. I don't really even think that there's a defense for his defense, the way he played defense this year. It was inattentive. It was so many times it kind of looked like he was walking around the defensive side of the court and not really paying nearly enough attention. I didn't think he was a particularly good on-ball defender. And, you know, it's kind of crazy because you look at the family lines. I mean, like, Matt Jones was at Duke and was an incredible wing defender, and it just doesn't seem that kind of mentality kind of filtered down to Mason. I do think he has some deficiencies, like he's not an elite-level lateral mover. He's definitely more of a guy who's, you know, thicker and gets into the paint and bullies other guys and draws fouls that way to get a lot of production, right? But and then in terms of the way that translates on defense, he's not going to be able to move his and slide his feet laterally all that well. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that, you know, production speaks for itself, and I'm comfortable saying that he should be all SEC, but, you know, I think that there were some better guys in the SEC this year that I would have been happy to give the award to.
So few, if any, have made the case that he should come back, and you laid out a lot of defensive deficiencies he could work on. If you were going to make the case for him to return to Arkansas for another year, which is out the window, would it be primarily to become a better defender? Is there any room for his offensive game to go to another level?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is defense. I would say just, you know, I mean, Mason's a kid that was heavier early in his life, right? Like, if I remember correctly, he was right around like 250, 260 pounds at one point in his life. And I think that, you know, he's focused a lot on, you know, really slimming down and getting his body into great shape. And I wonder if there's just continued work that he could do on his body to maybe continue to improve that lateral quickness, maybe instead of, you know, slimming down, you know, trying to do some more quickness and strength-based exercises to be able to add that quickness. I think that, you know, he shot the ball really well this year, and I think that he is definitely a good shooter. If he could take a further step as a shooter, I think that that would also really help him. But again, like, that's not a weakness of his game. I just think that, you know, you can maybe improve upon strength as well.
We're speaking with Sam Vecenie here on The Morning Rush. He covers the NBA draft, NBA, and college basketball for The Athletic. Sam, I remember listening to your Game Theory podcast with Cole Swicker a while back, and you guys had a love affair with Isaiah Joe, which obviously Arkansas fans really took to that. Now Isaiah Joe is at 70 in your latest mock draft. Mace is at 76. Why do you think Isaiah Joe has fallen so much this past season?
Yeah, I think the problem with Isaiah is that he didn't get a whole lot better this year. I kind of was hoping that the added weight. I think he added something like 15 pounds in the off season, and I was hoping that that, in addition to you know, improved skills as a ball handler, would kind of round out his game, because you know the big thing the NBA is looking for right now is, you know, we're all looking to find shooters, right? We're all looking to find guys that can really space the floor. And you know, I know Isaiah shot 34 from three this year. I'm not real worried about Isaiah shooting the basketball. I think he's definitely a great shooter, but I am a little bit more concerned about the rest of his game after kind of seeing what happened this year. I mean, I just talking to NBA teams, I think that it's a pretty real question as to whether or not he would get drafted if he ended up coming out this season.
Sam Vecenie with us here on the Morning Rush, talking NBA draft and college hoops. He works at the Athletic. The G League, the NBA's changed the rules so high school players can go directly to the G League if they're selected. What effect do you think this has on college basketball long term? Because obviously, if 5 or 10 or 12 of the best players a year opt out of college basketball, it's got to water down the product, Sam.
Yeah, right now I think that the effect is pretty minimal, just because we've only had three guys that really truly matter in the context of college basketball, maybe only two, to be honest, in Deshaun Nixon, Jalen Green, decide to go down this route. Long term, I think it just depends on how many kids that they can convince to take this route. I think it certainly works to water down the relevance of college basketball. I mean, I don't know how you guys felt this year, but certainly on my end, it felt like college basketball was even less relevant than what we've seen previously. Like, I honestly can't remember a season that just didn't have as many compelling storylines, didn't have as many compelling characters. Like, the basketball itself was as poor as I've seen it in recent years. So I think that, you know, stuff like this just continues to water down the product a little bit. But ultimately, college basketball got through the, you know, 8 to 10 year period where prior to the one and done, high school kids were able to go pro. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that the bigger issues college basketball has to struggle with are name, image, and likeness, you know, the ability for kids to make money off of themselves, and just generally kind of combating the feeling among elite level players that college basketball is a stepping stone as opposed to a destination.
Do you think in the short term, at least, the willingness or the desire to go play internationally with everything going on with COVID, are players going to be more reluctant to maybe look overseas internationally for opportunities?
Are you talking draft prospects particularly?
Yes, ones that don't make an NBA or a G League roster or have filtered out of that system. Do you think there's going to be reluctance to go play in China, to go play you know, somewhere in Europe like we've seen many players do previously?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure that it's going to be a reluctance based on coronavirus and the pandemic. There's certainly some guys I've talked to that want to stay closer to home if they can. But more than that, I think the bigger thing is just that there's a real chance that a lot of these leagues end up having to significantly reduce salary structures across the world. Like the NBL in Australia has already announced that next season all of their players are going to have to take a 50% haircut in terms of pay. So I think that more than anything, the how the salary situation shakes out in terms of professional basketball overseas is going to play the pivotal role in how many of these kids are going to be willing to go overseas to start their professional careers.
Speaking with Sam Vecenie here on the Morning Rush, Sam, Commissioner Goodell handled the NFL a lot different than many anticipated. How do you think Commissioner Silver handles the NBA draft and potentially the return of the NBA season?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the NBA draft is going to be just like a, you know, continuation of how they decide to handle the season. The lottery and combine were obviously postponed, and until we know what Adam Silver and company are going to do with the NBA season, you just literally can't have a lottery, because you need to know if they're going to play, you know, 3 to 6 more regular season games, because those games could affect the draft order at the end of the day. So until we know that, you can't have a lottery, and until you can't have a lottery, or until you have a lottery, you can't really have a genuine pre-draft process of trying to winnow down guys based on knowing where you're going to select, so, and knowing what teams are ahead of you in what order. So I think that it's going to be interesting to see what Adam Silver does. I think that there's definitely a true willingness on both the players and the NBA side to try and do as much as possible to make the season happen. Obviously, Roger Goodell was just in a much better spot than Adam Silver was entering this pandemic because his season was out of season. He hasn't had to make as many difficult decisions as Adam Silver has. You know, Adam Silver is in a really tough spot, and I think that ultimately the biggest impediment right now to the season beginning is just testing. And testing has to be so incredibly widespread across the country to where the NBA feels like it can take up as many tests as it needs to be able to jumpstart its season without anyone potentially creating a situation where they're going to infect multiple players across the basketball ecosystem.
So, Sam, with everything going on with the coronavirus right now, how is your process with draft evaluations changed?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a lot of tape watching. It's certainly trying to winnow down what guys are going to be in the draft, what guys are just testing the waters. That part of it has been a little bit more difficult to judge this year than in many years, if only because these guys that are legitimately testing the process don't really have an opportunity to be able to go out and work out for NBA teams and try to improve their standing for those NBA teams. So first it's trying to winnow down who's going to be in the draft, and then from there it's just watching a whole bunch of tape because there's nothing else to do right now. So that's basically the end of the day on the process here.
Sam, assuming there's no summer league in Vegas or Orlando, and I think that's a fair assumption, at least at this point, how does that affect players trying to establish themselves? Not only the new players coming out of the draft, but also those fringe players trying to make a roster. That's a great place to showcase your value as a player. That's got to be a real setback for those players that won't get those opportunities.
Yeah, I think that it's, you know, just very early to be able to say that there's not going to be any sort of summer league. Like, does the NBA downshift it into like a fall league maybe and just decide, okay, we finished the season in August if they do end up finishing the season, or we finished the season on Labor Day weekend here in August, or here in, you know, maybe mid-October, we're going to go ahead and do like a rookie camp. We're going to go ahead and do like a mini summer league out in Las Vegas. And then, you know, starting at December 25th, we're going to do the normal start of the season, which typically starts at the end of October. I think that that is still remains to be sorted out. If there was not a summer league situation, I think it's going to be a lot harder for rookies to get acclimated to the league. And I think it's going to be a lot harder for them to get acclimated to playbooks. And I would expect that, especially given that this draft class is not one that's particularly strong, we see a season next year where there are much fewer high-level impact rookies that perform within their first year.
So, Sam, assuming that Isaiah enters and stays in the draft, well, he's entered his name in the draft, assuming he stays in the draft and ends up going that direction, do you think, because of all the wrench that's been thrown in the process, do you think Mace and Isaiah are going to be helped or hurt by this? Because they're not exactly the most athletic guys. They're not going to be, there's not going to be a ton of combines and stuff. Do you think those two individuals are going to be helped or hurt by how the wrench has been thrown in this process?
Yeah, I think that Isaiah would probably be hurt because I think that he's someone that could go into one of these workouts and just shoot the, you know, cover off the ball, right? And a team would just fall in love with that, right? Like, that would really be able to help him get the taste of him shooting 34% from three out of evaluators' mouths. In the case of Mason, yeah, I mean, I don't know that it, like, helps or hurts him. Like, I think that he's one of those guys that in these three-on-three games that typically happen in these pre-draft workouts, he's just so strong and physical that he probably would be pretty well suited to playing three-on-three basketball. That increased space would probably help. It would help or hinder. In Isaiah's case, though, I think that him not being able to go into workouts and really just knock down a ton of shots and, make people remember that this guy is just an elite level shooter, I think that certainly hinders them.
Sam, do you have an opinion on Eric Musselman and his staff and what kind of developers they are of NBA talent?
Yeah, I think that they're awesome. I'm a big fan of Eric Musselman, and I'm a big fan of this entire staff. I think that, you look at the work that they did at Nevada. NC State couldn't get anything out of Caleb and Cody Martin, and I think that Musk and that staff ended up turning those guys into NBA players. They turned Jordan Caroline from a center at Southern Illinois into like a really good four man that sometimes slid down into the five, and a guy who became a shooter and became one of the best players in the Mountain West Conference. You can go up and down the list. Marcus Marshall, Kendall Stevens, these are guys that played better under Musselman than they did at their previous stops. And yeah, I think that his experience developing talent at the NBA level really helps them develop guys at a high level within the collegiate atmosphere as well.
Sam Fassini covers the NBA, the NBA draft, and college basketball for The Athletic. Sam, let me top off the interview with this. All eyes have been on Sunday night's ESPN, The Last Dance. Rate the doc 1 to 10, man.
I would say just in terms of my pure enjoyment that I get out of it every week, I would say like a really good 9. I love it. I'm having a blast reminiscing. In terms of like a journalistic entity, maybe like a 6. Like, it's not like incredible. I don't know that we're treading new ground here. I don't know that we're like finding out anything we didn't know previously. But in terms of the way it's stylized, the way it's propulsive, you just feel like an adrenaline rush every time that you watch it. Yeah, like a really solid 9, and I'm really glad that it exists.
It's good enough to watch twice each week. Watch it once, then DVR, watch it again. I think it's that entertaining, but you're right. As far as are we really getting to the core of the truth? Maybe not.
I think Michael Jordan's production company, yeah, Sam, might have something to do
with
that.
It's fun to watch when we got nothing else.
Yeah, like this was originally supposed to be something that was just like going to play during off days of the NBA Finals, right? Like, I think that says a lot about what ESPN thought of it at the time, and like thought the cultural impact of it would be. And because there's literally nothing else on in terms of sports content, it's kind of become a cultural phenomenon in a way that is kind of swept the nation. It feels like everyone, like even people that don't really love sports, I feel like are watching it. And even more than Michael Jordan production company, I feel like just the fact that they sold it to Netflix plays a role here too, because they recognize that it's going to be more of a general audience watching this thing. They sold the international rights to Netflix, and I think it's going to be on Netflix afterward. They realize it's going to be more of a general audience watching this as opposed to like a heavily engaged sports audience. So they had to keep it a bit more basic than what I would imagine is bubbling beneath the surface.
You can follow and read Sam Fassini's work at The Athletic. He covers the NBA draft, the NBA, and college basketball over there. Also follow him on Twitter at Sam_Fassini. Sam, we really appreciate the time, man, and be safe out there in L.A., okay, buddy?
Yep, you too. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a light and flavorful beer for those easy drinking occasions.
The crowd's into it. They just threw him out of the game. They just threw him out of the game. He's gotten his second technical, and he's been thrown out of the ball game.
Why Sam Pittman will succeed and why he will fail. This is one of the conversations we were going to get to on Friday, but we had so many great mother stories from Clay, Tommy, me, and so many of you that we skipped it and we're saving it for today. So everyone, whenever a new coach comes in, everyone is lavishing him. You rarely see anything negative about that said head coach in football, in basketball, in baseball. And listen, my thing is, like, the whole thing since I started, and I've gotten great advice from Clay, great advice from so many other people since I started the industry, is just to be honest. And just because you have an opinion about something doesn't mean it's always going to be positive. So, again, I just brought up the fact that I was curious why Arkansas made this move when they initially hired Sam Pittman, and the fact that he had no head coaching experience at the D1 level. And now, all of a sudden, he's presented in the SEC West, which is not only the toughest conference in college football, it's the toughest division in college football. And so everyone points to, well, he coached under Kirby Smart, he's been in Arkansas, and those are all great points. Like, I don't know if it validates anything, but guys, let's be honest, there are some negatives that could happen with this coaching staff, particularly Sam Pittman. We can't just paint rainbows and sunshine all over the sports radio airwaves and say, this is going to be great. Because that's what happened with Chad Morris. If we go back to 2017, when Chad Morris was hired in December, you will not see a single sports radio article, hear a sports radio segment, or see a TV bit where people were just ripping the Chad Morris hire. It just didn't happen. And I'm not ripping the Sam Pittman hire, but I am going to tell you that there could be some drawbacks to his time at Arkansas. And I'll let you guys get into the positives first. And then I'll kind of go on the other side and switch it up a little bit. So I don't know if Clay or Tommy, which one of you want to go first? But
well, first of all, the last two hires, the choice you ended up with, Chad Morris and Sam Pittman, they weren't the first choices of administration in either search. There were other guys that the school targeted, administration targeted first. But Sam Pittman was the guy that wanted the job. And that's what carried him across the finish line.
Important.
He wanted the job. They weren't having to beg him to take it. He wanted it, and that was the difference in those searches and why Sam Pittman is the coach here now. But let's be honest, there was other guys that said no or weren't interested before it came back around to Sam Pittman getting the job. So, that's kind of a common denominator in these last two searches. So that's one thing.
First of all, I'm not – you asked me to do the positives, and I'm going to start with the biggest negative. And it doesn't have anything to do with Sam Pittman. It's what he inherited, and that's why he could fail. And it is a bunch of junk. And it's a tough collection of talent. When I say tough, I mean I don't mean they're tough. I mean it's tough on Sam that they don't have all the parts needed. And the offensive line is got some experience, but. You know, they're not the most talented group in the SEC. I like Ty Clary and some of the others in this bunch. And I think that they're Myron Cunningham, we may see his best football. We saw a little glimpse of him last year, but I think this would be his year. Be a senior offensive tackle in a new system that kind of highlights him. But there, it's going to be a rebuilt defense. Barry Odom is. It's just to me, it's a lot to think that they're going to be competitive with the talent level that they've inherited, and that's the downsize. So that might have not been where you thought I was going to go, Ty. But I think that's out there, and we have to be real.
Let me, and you mentioned Barry Odom. I think that's one of the positives. I think you were looking for in the conversation. I think the upgrade in the overall staff. Is pretty notable, pretty remarkable in the fact that I think the quality of this staff versus what the last 2 years have had at Arkansas under Chad Morris is going to be noticed in the on-the-field product.
Especially the two coordinator positions, arguably, and even with the addition of Scott Fallon, that's basically another special, that's a special teams coordinator.
And I think Davis on the O-line versus Dustin Frye is, there's a lot of SEC pedigree.
It's a home run.
Clay, you know it as well as anyone. The quality of what's on this staff and their SEC experience, Chad Morris's staff can't even come close to comparing or competing with just the SEC experience that Sam Pittman's staff brings.
Yeah, you had John Chavis and Ron Cooper and Steve Caldwell who definitely had SEC experience, but not on the offensive side. There wasn't any. And you know, the what I see happening that's the positive is that the it looks like they upgraded talent on the defensive side. They had brought in better talent on the offensive side, especially at wide receiver and running back under Chad Morris, and now I think you'll see the benefits of that with probably a better plan, you know, with Kendall Briles. And that's why I think they're going to succeed is that these guys know how to coach their units. Without question, what really stunk in the first year of the Chad Morris time was special teams. And we can go back and pick out the most horrible plays that embarrassed on national TV, the no fair catch punt that was mm-hmm. that was allowed to run and score a touchdown. And you know, there's other situations where you saw things just blow up. Now the kicking, you had Connor Limpert, it was pretty solid in field goal, and they got better in the second year. But I think that they have a chance with Scott Fountain to have really deluxe special teams, and that's the recipe for winning Arkansas football. It's the way Frank Burrell's won. And, you know, a return guy like Traylon Burks, and I think that's what he's going to be. He's going to be a punt returner and kickoff guy that is now 231 pounds and has speed and ability to make plays. So that I think the positives are really good for where they're going. And as you say, the assistants, the staff is put together in the right way, in my opinion.
What about the loss of Jeff Traylor and Barry Lunny Jr.? I mean, you think about how Barry Lunny Jr. was like the probably biggest assistant from Arkansas on the side of the state. Obviously played quarterback for the Razorbacks. You think about Traylor, one of the main reasons, if not the biggest reason, Rakeem Boyd ended up at Arkansas. We talk about the additions, but are those subtractions? How substantial are those?
Yeah, Barry's a solid coach. Where you might miss him the most won't be on the field. It would be probably his ability to lead recruiting around the state of Arkansas. And mm-hmm. that's why he was hired by Brett Bielema, is that they wanted somebody that would hold together and the high school coaches would know. That was deemed important. Now, you've got Justin Stepp, who's been here for 2 years and now kind of has an idea of who the guys are around the state. As far as overall coaching ability, I think Barry's is solid, no doubt. But I think who they brought in, John Cooper, is really a good tight ends coach and probably knows more about the position than Barry did when Barry came. He had never coached tight ends. So he'd coach quarterbacks and it's hard to – difficult question. You're asking me about one of my friends, and do I think Barry Lunny was a really good coach? Yeah, I do, and I'm very close to the family. It's kind of like asking me to talk about Tim Horton. Are they going to miss Tim Horton? They're going to miss – they miss those guys in the – you know, when Bielema didn't hire Tim or Tim didn't decide to stay, whichever way you want to look at that. You miss the intangibles. You miss the ability to have the knowledge of the program, to be able to speak. And I think that's one of the things that Chad Morris used and Brett Bielema used when, hey, this is what Arkansas is all about. So you miss that. And I'm not going to say that won't be missed because it will. But I think as far as the coaching X's and O's and ability to coach players, this staff is solid all the way through, including the tight end position and including the running back position.
I want to go back to something you brought up earlier, and that's special teams and the fact that Sam Pittman has arranged his staff to have a special teams coordinator. And that's something I think fans have wanted. I don't know exactly how much you're going to see a difference immediately in the product on the field with the lack of depth this team has always struggled with by having someone that's tabbed a coordinator of special teams. But what do you think will happen by it's Scott Fountain that's the special teams coordinator. What, do you think we'll notice a difference as observers and fans that, hey, this is a team that's clearly taking a step forward because they've put more of an emphasis with the coaching staff on special teams?
I think you will. And I think Chad Morris did that in his second year. He brought in Daniel DiPrato, and they kind of joined forces with Barry Lunny and coached up the special teams. But I think that you'll see improvement. It really looked like in the offseason their desire to get a kickoff man that could put it deep, you know, would say, okay, we're not going to have to cover kickoffs as much because we're going to, for the first time, and gosh, it's been a long time, that you have a kickoff man that can put it, you know, 5 to 10 yards deep where they're not returnable. And that really helps. Can you just remember the kickoff returns against Texas A&M that just broke their back in a couple of those games where it looked like they might win break that series drought.
Christian Kirk taking it back. So it's going to be nightmares, Clay.
Yeah, special teams gaffes. Those have to, you know, and if you're playing in Jerry's world, there is no win, right? It's a constant zero. And there's no reason you can't you allow a kickoff to be returned because you don't have a man that can kick it 10 yards deep.
Yeah. You know, and you think about, you know, having the specialist you mentioned, Burke being a return man, someone that can break open a game, can get you a couple extra first downs. And that's just something Arkansas has, you know, has struggled in is to get momentum and not give up momentum in the kicking game.
Yeah, see, you know, a few more running backs committed. You know, running backs can play on special teams. You know, I can't help but remember seeing guys like throughout history of Arkansas. You know, when Arkansas was good, you know, they had Lance Allworth and Ken Hatfield returning punts. Do you realize that they led the nation 3 different times with those two guys?
Jeez,
I mean, it's. You wonder why they were good. It was because they had players like that. Had players like Jim Lindsay playing on special teams. You know, another running back who was a great pro is a special teams player with the Vikings. You know, then you fast forward to where you had Felix Jones and Darren McFadden both on the field on kickoffs, and Felix would return the kick, but McFadden would blow up the first guy, you know, that came through. I mean, blow him up. And, you know, there's a legendary story about Urban Meyer one year pulled up some Arkansas tape, and they weren't even playing Arkansas. And he's got, like, guys, I want y'all to watch this. And it was Darren McFadden blocking on kickoffs. And he said, if an All-American can do this, he says, what can we ask for our best players on special teams? And that's a perfect. You know, the more running backs you have, the better your special. Running backs, linebackers, and tight ends make your special teams great. And, you know, there hadn't been a lot of those kind of players, you know, at Arkansas to put on special teams, and that's why they haven't been good. So your recruiting improves, and you've got somebody that's going to be really good at grabbing a guy and convincing him that this is how you're going to help this team is play on special teams in that first year.
I remember Peyton Hillis. I don't know how much of a punt returner he was. He was a good punt catcher, but he was back there fielding those punts because they knew he could
north,
take the
south.
Leaps.
Yeah, north, south.
And he'd get you
he'd
a few yards.
It.
But
yeah, he'd catch it with his hands, and he went north, south. And it just Tim Horton, great punt returner, same deal. He'd catch it, go north, south. Now you remember Shep Campbell, the same thing. I'm sorry, Stedman Campbell. You know, catch it, get north south, and it's yards, and even, you know, catch some of them that, you know, you didn't think maybe he should, but he, you know, so sure handed, and he would get north south with it.
And Clay, when you look at the SEC West right now, that would be another thing that I mean, Sam Pittman has no control over, but he's something that unfortunately he's going to have to deal with. You mentioned earlier Arkansas's position as far as the guys they have on campus. Well, if you also just look at the SEC West, Saban's going to be there, and how much longer we don't know, but he's there right now. Ed Orgeron and LSU are coming off a national championship. Yes, they lost 14 players to the NFL draft and other free agent signings, but that team looks like they'll be at least giving Arkansas a tough time next year, along with Texas A&M. We'll see how the Mississippi schools do. We'll see how Auburn does with the addition of Chad Morris. But, I mean, it's so difficult to navigate to a conference, the toughest division in college football, when you are at a point where, as you mentioned, I don't know if you go as far to say, but I will, Arkansas has the least amount of talent on the roster compared to other SEC schools, at least when Sam Pittman got here.
Well, What I'll say, I don't see the other rosters, so you can say that. I just don't know. I mean, I don't know how much studying you've done of other rosters.
I'd be lying if I told you it was a lot.
Yeah, so when somebody says that, I don't take a lot of credence in that because this is what I do for a living. I can tell you a lot about Arkansas. I can't really tell you about the rosters of the other team. I don't know what a 60-man roster, travel roster is at Ole Miss right now. I don't know what Mississippi State. I kind of know Alabama. They're off the charts because of their recruiting. But as far as, you know, looking at Vanderbilt's roster, Mississippi State's roster right now after their last graduate, which I think was significant too, and I think that's part of why Joe Moorhead is gone, is that his recruiting wasn't up to what they'd been doing previously with Dan Mullen. I mean, I think that there's no doubt Mississippi State's fixing to take a dive. And, you know, it's everybody talks about Leach being able to coach, and it's like, but that you got to have players. And they had players, especially linemen, and they've been wiped out the last 2 years of those really NFL-type or all-SEC-type offensive and defensive linemen. The LSU situation is different. They have players, but they're going to be so much more inexperienced. And they lost two of their aces in coaching. Dave Aranda, don't minimize that loss. Mm-hmm. Now head coach at Baylor. And Joe Brady, who's now offensive coordinator, assistant head coach, I think, with Carolina, with he's moved to the NFL.
Panthers. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, you know, we got to, you know, they still got Steve Ensminger, who was their de facto offensive coordinator with, you know, Joe Brady was calling the passing plays, but he understands that offense. Now, can he coach quarterbacks? No, he's going to have somebody else do that. He's not a quarterback coach. He's
got Scott Linehan from the Cowboys in there.
But we'll see how that works. A lot of moving parts, a lot of newness, and they have nothing as far as preparation. You know, just remember that they didn't have a chance to tinker around with guys and have spring practice. It's there's so many ifs about this season. And at first you say, well, that's a tough break for Arkansas because, you know, they're rebuilding. But it's the same for everybody else. So it might, you know, it might cause some turmoil that you take advantage of. I'm just saying it works both ways.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Bud Light Seltzer, 5% ABV and only 100 calories. We'd put it up against any other seltzer out there.